would have thought that only God can be the source of healing. Kamash Malan, the Torah is teaching me that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to use whatever science and knowledge and wisdom we have, because that also comes from Hashem. In other words, to say, only Hashem does it and I don't do it, that implies that what I do is somehow divorced from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu that gave us the knowledge and the wisdom and the understanding. So to say that I'm not supposed to use it is not affirming emunah in Hashem. It is exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do to alleviate misery. So we start off with the idea that a priori, Judaism, the Torah does not prohibit advanced technologies, whether it's in vitro fertilization, whether it would be cloning. You can't stam, as I say, something is prohibited because it is man-made rather than natural. Because if it is for the alleviation of human suffering and misery, it is nichlal in the heter and the mitzvah of refuah. Nitein rishus l'rope l'rapos. Now, there are, of course, different minority views that you could find in many midrashim. For example, there's a fascinating gemara in Psachim. The gemara in Brachos quotes it about Chizkiyo HaMelech. It says Chizkiyo HaMelech was a very righteous king, did a number of things, some of which the Chachamim liked and some of which the Chachamim didn't like. And one of the things he did that the Chachamim liked was he was Gonez Sefer Refuas. What is Sefer Refuas? Sefer Refuas was an ancient book that listed all of the medicines and what they were good for, like a physician's desk reference. And he took it away. And that was a good thing. But the Gemara doesn't say what was so good about it. So listen to the Machlokas, Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi says it was a good thing because people were over-relying on medicine and they were not turning to Hashem and they did not have emunah that Hashem was the source. So it was kedai for Chizkiyo to take away medical knowledge from the community to force them to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is what Rashi says. The Rambam, you might expect, you might even guess that the Rambam would not like this particular interpretation. The Rambam himself was a great doctor. Now the Rambam, although the Rambam lived towards the end of Rashi's life, their lives overlap. There is, I believe, no evidence that the Rambam was aware of Rashi. But the Rambam brings an explanation, which is the same as Rashi's, why Chizkiyo was Gainei Sefer Refuas, and the Rambam ridicules it. The Rambam says, anyone that says that a maimon in Hashem should not seek medical treatment is the same as a person who says, I'm not going to eat because Hashem is going to feed me. I mean, Hashem gives you the food. You have the responsibility to ingest it. So too, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created mechanisms in the world that can help us b'derech hateva, and we are mechuyev to utilize those mechanisms. Now, I'm not going to address today the issue of alternative medicine. I mean, again, halacha does not necessarily say one type of medicine is better than another. That is a scientific matter that needs to be decided. But the notion that emunah means I don't take steps b'derech hateva for my health, the Rambam says is a great mistake. In fact, it's similar to a joke they tell. Unfortunately, it's not as funny because tragedies have actually happened, about the person who was trapped in a flash flood, and you know the story, and the boats came by, and the helicopters came by, and the airplanes came by, and he keeps on turning them down. I don't need you. I believe in God. God takes care of me. And the water is getting higher and higher, and he goes to the second story, and then he goes to the attic, and then he goes to the roof, and he turns down every single attempt, and in his last moments when it's too late, he cries out to the Almighty and he says, God, I've been your faithful servant. Why have you not saved me? And Hashem answers him, I tried to save you 5 times. Who do you think sent the helicopter and the airplane? How did you want me to save you? Now, we're coming up to Kriyas Yamsuf on Shri Shal Pesach, so once in a while, Hashem opens up the water. But according to Halacha, Baruch Hashem, miracles do happen, and even to this very day, miracles sometimes happen. But according to Halacha, you are not allowed to deliberately make decisions on the assumption that a miracle happens. If Nebuch, a massive, is hopeless, so you can hope for a miracle. But you can't say when you have an avenue that could help, I'm going to be Samech HaNisim, I don't need these avenues. That would be irresponsible. So because of this, the Rambam rejects Rashi's interpretation, and the Rambam offers an opposite interpretation
of what it means to be Ganei Sefer Refuas. And this is an interpretation that would be fully endorsed, at least by the American Medical Association and probably the Israeli Association as well. And that is, the Rambam says, the problem with Sefer Refuot was that lay people were reading it and not going to doctors, and they were self-medicating. And the Rambam says it's very well known that if lay people try to take care of their medical care, they're going to make very, very serious mistakes. So Chizkiyahu removes medical information from the uneducated lay public so that people would go to the professionals, as opposed to doing it on their own. Mamish, exactly the opposite of what Rashi says. Rashi says it was designed to close off medical progress so that people would seek spiritual healing. According to the Rambam, it was designed to take away medical information from unqualified people. And indeed, this is a bit the problem the Rambam identified is actually a contemporary problem. You know, we have the blessing and the curse of the internet, and the internet puts a tremendous, and I'm putting aside all the other problematical areas, but the internet puts a tremendous wealth of medical information out there, some of which is junk, some of which is accurate, some of which might be understood, some of which is often not understood. But as a result, patients now come to physicians with a lot more stuff that they read than in the olden days. So in the olden days, which I remember even growing up, you know, medicine was kind of a black box. A doctor told you what to do, and you did not question, and you did not have a counter opinion. And in fact, he didn't even explain. It was just, this is what you do. You know, you don't have to know. You don't have to know why. Now, every person comes in as a doctor, and although it is sometimes the case, that the patient can actually inform the doctor of things that the doctor might not have been aware of, but often it is the case that there's just a lot of confusion and misunderstanding. So the Rambam is making the point that sometimes lay people, you know, too much information overload can in fact result in very bad decisions. So that's the machlokas about Gonei's Sefer Refuas. Now, there is a Mishnah in Kedushin, with apologies to any physicians in the audience, but you know the Mishnah. The Mishnah talks about ideal professions, and the Mishnah mentions sailors are God-fearing people, so that's a good profession. The person believes in Hashem because they're in danger. But then it mentions Tov Shebarokim, the best of the doctors, the Gehenim, is going to go to hell. Now, L'chora, that's a bit of a problem. I mean, many of the greatest Gedolim were in fact doctors and the like. And of course, giving medical treatment is a mitzvah of Hashava Saveda. The Gemara makes a kal v'chomer. If returning a lost object is a mitzvah, then returning lost health, how much? See, halachically, you have to understand, there is a mitzvah on a patient to seek medical treatment, if necessary. Ushmartem es nafsho seichem. There is a mitzvah on either the physician or the healthcare provider to provide medical treatment. That is the mitzvah of Hashava Saveda. It's a great, great mitzvah. So why would it be called the Gehenim? So it's very interesting that the Tiferes Yisrael, the great commentary on the Mishnah, offers a nice interpretation. He says, Tov Shebarofim Gehenim means the doctor who fancies himself such a specialist, such an expert, that he will not consult with his inferiors. And if as a result of his gaiva, that he has nothing to learn from somebody else, the patient suffers, Hashem will hold that doctor responsible. If the doctor did everything he could, and never the patient didn't recover, that's not the doctor's fault. But if the doctor's gaiva prevented him from either admitting a mistake or consulting with his inferiors, that doctor goes to Gehenna because the patient suffered because of him. That's the Tiferet Yisrael's pshat. Homiletically, Derech Drush, some want to say this, Tov is begematria, take the gematria of Tov, Tov is 17. So we know that we call the Amida Shmona Esrei, 18, although it has 19 brachas from a later date, but initially it was 18 blessings. So Tov Shebarofim means the doctor who only believes in 17 of the 18 blessings of the Amida, meaning the blessing that says, Rufa'inu Hashem, that Hashem is the source of refuah, that he doesn't believe, he thinks it's up to him, that doctor goes to Gehenna. But Lehetach, a doctor that believes in all 18 blessings, is Chai. He's a source of life, he's a conduit. That doctor does great mitzvahs. Now, I heard a pshat from a doctor once, and it's very beautiful, but it's unlettered. It doesn't really fit the sense of the passage. He learned this way. Tov shebarokum legehenim means the best of the doctors will go to hell with their patients. Meaning to say, as opposed to the professional detachment in which you don't get emotionally involved, the best physician will feel the pain. Because that's a great, great dilemma. It's a great, great dilemma. Because it is true that if you're too emotionally involved, that can distort your judgment. That is why a parent should not be a physician for his own child, or a child, putting aside the halachic issues of injection, should not be a physician for a parent, because or for a spouse, or whatever it is, because you're too emotionally involved. But because of this, because of the pain that a doctor might see, you sometimes develop, I think just to a lesser degree, a rabbi goes through the same thing, you have to develop a certain insensitivity, a lack of feeling, and that itself can be very, very destructive. So the truly gifted person manages to still have the empathy and the compassion and the feeling and the connection, but doesn't allow it to distort their judgment. And that is the pshat. The best doctor, when the patient goes towards Gehenna, that doctor is with him. The doctor is not abandoning him. He's on the journey. They tell the story of a great, great Lithuanian gadol, Rav Isaac Lacharif. The Vaisal of the Sharp One, you'll see from the story why he was given that nickname, that once he was very ill, and his doctor abandoned him. The doctor told the family in the middle of the night, he's going to die overnight, so I'm going home, there's no purpose for me staying here all night, I'm going home. Of course, at least in those days, they still made house calls. They're not even going to get the doctor there in the first place. So, Baruch Hashem, a nace happened, and Rav Vaisal got better. It was a refuah shleima. And 3 weeks later, the doctor is walking in the street, and he sees Rav Isaac Lacharif walking. And he turns white as if he saw a ghost. And he blurts out, unthinkingly, I thought you were dead. Not the right thing to say. So Rav Isaac says, I did die, and I did you a great taiva. I ran up to Shemayim, and I saw a gate in Shemayim. And I saw a bunch of people in line to go into that gate. I saw you there, too. And I asked the Malach, what is this gate, and who are these people? And the Malach said, this is the gate to Gehenna. And these are all the doctors. Tov shebarokum legehenna. And I said to the angel, let that man go. He is no doctor. So he says, I saved you from Gehenna. So you owe me a lot of gratitude for that. Okay. So we start off with the basic idea that the Torah basically says that what we can do to alleviate human misery is a good thing. We don't condemn technologies because you're playing God. You have to identify specific halachic problems and work with those halachic problems. But if there's no halachic problem, you don't start off with a general idea, I can't do it. It's the other way around. What I'm able to do to improve human welfare, I am permitted and commanded to do, unless and until I encounter a halachic problem. The Maral makes this point, interestingly enough, by Kalayim. The Torah does prohibit species mixing, right? You're not allowed to interbreed animals, you're not allowed to interbreed plants, and the reason is because Hashem created things in a certain way, but the Maral says the following. The Maral says, by the very fact that the Torah prohibited specific interventions implies that as a general principle, we don't go beyond the specific. It's very interesting. Instead of saying, oh, this exemplifies the attitude of leaving things the way they are, the Maral says, no, the Torah defines in specific contexts that you leave things the way they are. But other than that, it is part of man's mission. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik, in his very, very wonderful classic essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, which was initially in Tradition Journal, and now it's been reprinted as a separate little book. He talks about the fact that this is the very meaning of man being made in the image of God. That Hashem gave us autonomy, creativity, that emuna is not passive. Faith in Hashem is not quiescent. You don't simply look at the world and accept it as is. What I cannot change, it is my responsibility of Gamzu L'Tova not to question, not to complain, to accept this. But what is within our ability to change, it is imperative. That's why Judaism drains the swamps, and that's why Judaism fights for social justice. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us his partners in making the world a better place. In fact, someone learned, you know, it's interesting that in the American years of slavery, before the Civil War, religion was often used as a way of keeping the slaves passive by believing, this life could be miserable, but in the world to come, everything will be fine. So someone is saying, you know, when Moshe Rabbeinu asked Paro for a day off, so Paro actually gave them Shabbos, right? That's a medrash, that Moshe asked for Shabbos, and Paro gave Shabbos. And the question is, why is Paro such a nice guy? So someone is saying, because Paro figured, if they have their Shabbos, they think about Olam Haba, they're not going to complain about their working conditions, because religion is kind of looking at the next world, not looking at this world. They didn't realize that Moshe Rabbeinu had a different orientation here, and this would be a force for freedom and for Geula, and Paro really didn't realize what he was getting himself into at the time. Okay, so I want to talk about one specific technology that's extraordinarily interesting, promising, and raises some fascinating halachic questions, which have by now have been addressed, but at least the discussion is interesting. Let us take something like stem cell research. Now, what are stem cells? We know that in the human body, there are over 200 different types of cells, whether it's skin cells, kidney cells, spinal cord cells, brain cells, heart cells, right? We have cells. But when an embryo is fertilized, right, whether it's in vitro or in the woman's womb, right? So you have the sperm and the egg creating a blastocyst which divides, etc. In its initial stages of division, you don't have differentiated cells. When a sperm fertilizes an egg and it begins to divide, you don't yet have skin and liver and kidney, etc. All you have are undifferentiated cells. Because what's interesting is, in every single cell in the human body is the entire genetic code. It's an amazing thing. In my skin cell is the DNA for heart, liver, and kidney. In my kidney cell is the DNA for skin. And initially, in other words, within every cell is everything. What happens is, initially, therefore, the cell has not yet acquired an identity. Somebody once described stem cells as cells that haven't yet decided what they want to do when they grow up. Meaning, it's an undifferentiated cell. And then eventually, in the course of embryonic development, what happens in a very mysterious way is that in the skin cell, the DNA for heart, liver, and kidney shuts off, and only the skin DNA encoding gets expressed, and vice versa. So there's a switching, there's an on and off switching mechanism in which cells become differentiated and acquire their specific identity. But that begins to occur maybe 2 weeks to 3 weeks after fertilization. Initially, all you have are these stem cells that are undifferentiated. So around 15 years ago, it was discovered that if you take these stem cells, number one, you can culture them, you can grow stem cell lines, and number two, you can then direct these stem cells to become specific tissue types. Heart cells, liver cells, spinal cord cells, and the like. Now, stem cells do come in different places. There are embryonic stem cells, which are the harvested stem cells from fertilized embryos, usually in vitro, although not necessarily, in the first 2 or 3 weeks after fertilization. There are also stem cells in bone marrow from adults. There are stem cells in placenta, etc. But the moral and halachic debate about stem cells is almost exclusively embryonic stem cells for the following reason. In other words, adult stem cells are Baruch Hashem, there's virtually no halachic controversy or even ethical controversy about them at all. And indeed, there are some very great researchers that say we have underutilized the potential of adult stem cells. I heard a cardiac surgeon in Texas basically say he has had tremendous success in injecting stem cells into damaged heart valves, adult stem cells, into damaged heart valves, and they kind of repaired the valve. So it may very well be that perhaps we're assuming too much that we need the embryonic stem cells, but let's just assume that researchers want to work with embryonic stem cells. Now, the problem with embryonic stem cells, so again, there are amazing things you can do. You can culture the stem cells to be spinal cord tissue that can help people with Parkinson's or brain tissue, help people with seizures, heart valve. In theory, although we're not there yet, you might be able to use stem cells to construct entire organ systems, to construct a heart from stem cells. Now, we haven't figured out the glue that will keep. We can create cardiac tissue, but we haven't figured out how to create a whole organ system. But if you think about that, that would be enormously helpful because it would solve the problem of shortage of organs. It would also solve the halakhic problem, which I probably will not talk about today, of whether halakha allows you to take organs from brain-dead donors. That's a very, very serious issue. If we could literally create the organs in the laboratory with stem cells, we would avoid all of those problems. So the potential for stem cells is absolutely tremendous, and indeed, some of that potential has already been realized to some degree. But here is the problem. Just like the old saying, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Generally speaking, in order to get embryonic stem cells, you have to harvest them from a human embryo in an in vitro fertilization. And the problem is, in the course of harvesting that human, the stem cells from that human embryo, the embryo is destroyed. That which potentially could have become a human life, or is a human life, we'll talk about that, has to be destroyed. So the question is, does halacha permit the harvesting of embryonic stem cells, or do I treat it as an early form of abortion, which generally speaking is going to be forbidden? Now, the Catholic Church, as you know, which is very, very strict on abortion, they consider abortion to be murder. Halacha may not go to that same degree. They have taken, they've been very consistent at least, although, as Emerson once remarked, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, but they've been relentlessly consistent, and they have taken the position that embryonic stem cell harvesting is tantamount to abortion. It is murder. It cannot be allowed even to save a life, because their position is abortion is not allowed even to save the life of the mother, because who says the fetus is any worse than the mother? I will say, I'm not here to bash the Catholics, because they are consistent, but I do want to point out one very simple point that I think that the Church's position needs to ponder. And that is, if you create a rule that says no harvesting of embryonic stem cells, the result of that rule is not going to be that a bunch of these babies are going to be born and come to term. The result is, instead of using stem cells, these embryos are going to be flushed down the toilet or thrown away. Meaning, we now have thousands and thousands of what are called, in not a very nice way, spare embryos. Sometimes in vitro fertilization, there are more embryos than can be safely implanted, and there may be no interest in freezing them or whatever it is. So these embryos are going to die one way or the other, or be destroyed one way or the other. So the question is, if the choice would be harvest embryonic stem cells or bring the embryos to term, that's one type of question. But if the question is harvest the embryonic stem cells or throw them away, that's a very different type of question. As far as I know, the Catholic Church has not been advocating adopt an embryo. They have not been making that point. So the truth is, if their policy is designed to promote life, an embryonic stem cell ban is not really promoting life. Okay, but be it as it may, I'm not here to really talk about their position so much, except to compare it to halacha. Now, one other thing, that in the United States, there had been a great, great debate before 9/11. 9/11 totally overshadowed the stem cell debate. If you remember, in August 2001, if you go back a number of years, this was the big item in the news, and then 9/11 kind of put it on the back burner. And there was a lot of discussion about the government funding embryonic stem cell research. President Bush the first was against it, etc. But basically, there are presently no restrictions on this since Obama and Clinton, and now the federal government funds it. But the truth of the matter is, even if the federal government wouldn't fund it, there's plenty of private money. It's a very big thing in Israel. Israel is actually one of the world's leaders in embryonic stem cell research, as they are in many, many aspects of medical technology. And for those of you that are involved in biotech, I just want to point out that in the United States, whether the federal government supports something or doesn't support something is not as important as it used to be. 20 or 30 years ago, if the federal government did not support a technology, it essentially died. Today, there is so much big money in biotech that many people don't even want federal government money, because when there's federal government money, there is supervision and rules and restrictions. They would rather make as much money as they can. So the whole big debate of whether the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, are going to fund biotechnology or not is frankly a much less important she'ela than it used to be 20 or 30 years ago. Okay. So what would halakha? So let's say again, and so let's try to analyze this from the perspective of a very practical question. Okay, maybe that's the easiest way to focus it. We have a religious couple. The religious couple has having trouble having children. So they go to a fertility specialist, Israel, United States, England, wherever it is, and they agree to enroll in an in vitro fertilization program. Baruch Hashem, in Eretz Israel, these programs are paid for in a much more generous way than they are in the United States. So this is a good place to go for fertility treatments, as well as halakhic sensitivity. Now, when you enroll in an in vitro fertilization program, you have to sign a lot of contracts. And one of the issues that the contracts address is, what do you do with more embryos than can be safely implanted? Because in an in vitro fertilization, they commonly want to take as many eggs as they can to increase the chance that there'll be a good fertilization. So they may take, you know, they'll administer drugs for super ovulation. They may take out 20 eggs or 15 eggs or 12 eggs, and they expose them to sperm, etc. And maybe one gets fertilized, maybe two gets fertilized, maybe 10 get fertilized. So the question that you have to sign in the contract is, if the doctor feels that no more than four can be safely implanted, although we had OptoMom in California that had eight, so what do you want us to do with the extra fertilized eggs? So here are the options that you will be offered. Now again, I'm not addressing clinics that follow halakha, they'll give you halakha options, but in America you'll be given different options. Hadassah will give you different options. Option one, freeze the embryos for later use. Baruch Hashem, that by far is an absolutely good option. It wasn't available until recently, but no, use the embryos later, which is an interesting idea, though, that you may have embryos that were fertilized the same time, but that were born years apart, but that's okay. I mean, halakhically, that's the way it is. So option number one is perfectly fine. Freeze embryos for later use. You can check that box for sure. Option number two, donate embryos to other infertile couples. Now that sounds like a very, very generous and kind-hearted gesture, and indeed it probably comes from motives of kindness. All I can tell you is, without getting into all the details, halakhically that is extremely, extremely problematical, simply because there'll be a whole question, who is the halakhic, not so much who is the halakhic father, the halakhic father is clearly the one whose sperm fertilized the embryo, but who is the halakhic mother? Is the halakhic mother the genetic egg that was fertilized, or is the halakhic mother the birth mother? In the United States, where a donation could theoretically go to a non-Jewish woman, you're going to have a whole problem. Is this a Jew or a goy? And if he's a Jew, how are you allowed to have him raised as a goy, etc.? And there may be a problem of potential incest in the future, siblings who are siblings. So as generous as it might seem, generally speaking, halakha would not encourage embryo donation. Okay, option three, use the embryo for medical research, such as the obtaining of stem cells. And that's exactly where we're up to. So now we're exactly at that point, is that permitted? So let me give you different svaras that were given, and then show why they may or may not provide a framework for a hetzer. We know, of course, that halacha generally does prohibit abortion unless the mother's life is in danger. That is an isser. Again, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, at least for a Jew, aborting a fetus is not a capital crime. It is not murder. It is not the same as the Catholic Church. It is not ritzicha. You are not chayav misa for the abortion of a fetus. But that doesn't mean it's mutter. It is considered to be usher unless the mother's life is in danger. And in terms of whether the mother's life is in danger, that's a very tricky question, because halacha recognizes extreme psychological stress as life endangerment. So, for example, you sometimes hear a pro-life person say, I'm against abortion except in cases of rape or incest. Now, that's not that logical. I mean, it's not the baby's fault, rape or incest. And you couldn't kill a baby that was born from rape or incest. So why can you kill the fetus? The way halacha would analyze rape or incest, halacha does not have a category called rape or incest. Halacha has a category called pikuach nefesh. It is recognized that it may be that the extreme traumatic nature of such a conception may, I'm not saying will, may be so severe that it may amount to a life-threatening event, depending on the circumstances and the support system. So there may, I'm not saying will, may have pikuach nefesh aterim under certain circumstances. So we don't have a category called rape or incest. We have a category called pikuach nefesh. And that plays out depending on the facts of the particular case. And obviously, before you terminate a pregnancy based on pikuach nefesh, you have to provide all of the resources that could make that unnecessary, even if it means adoption or whatever it be. Baruch Hashem, we have in Eretz Yisrael the great society, the great organization Efrat, and not to be confused with the city, but which helps women in trouble to be able to carry a baby to term, either give up for adoption or raise the baby and keep the baby at home and the like. I'm not going to discuss the big machlokas, the Tzitz Eliezer's very famous or even infamous psak that permitted abortion of Tay-Sachs fetuses for up to 6 months into the pregnancy. Rav Moshe Feinstein strongly disagreed with that psak. But okay, these are issues. But if we just talk about plain bread and butter pregnancies, it is safe to say halacha does not allow abortion. Understanding that there's pikuach nefesh, understanding there may be other shikulim in certain cases. But the classic case where we do allow abortion, of course, is if the mother's life is in danger. So, here is one argument that people make. One argument people make is that what about abortion less than 40 days? Right? Abortion less than 40 days. So there is a Gemara that says that an embryo that is less than 40 days from conception only has the status of mere water. So some have tried to argue that that would mean if it only has the status of mere water, abortion would be permitted. Now, here though, it's extremely important that you never resolve halachic matters by just picking out quotations. You have to look at the context in which that phrase appears. The Gemara does say, an embryo less than 40 days is only mere water. That does appear in the Gemara. But what is the Gemara saying it about? The Gemara is saying it about a korban. Right? The Torah says in Vayikra that a woman after childbirth has to bring a korban, right? A korban yoledes. But it says, and that's even if there's a miscarriage, God forbid. But if the miscarriage was so early, I don't even know how she would know that, but if the miscarriage was so early that it was less than 40 days, there is no korban because it's mayim. Now, let me show you why that is irrelevant on the abortion issue. Mayim bialma says that less than 40 days, the fetus does not have the status of a person. It does say that. But the prohibition of abortion in halacha is not based on fetal personhood. Because if the fetus would be a person, then abortion would be murder. The very fact that it's not murder, it's something else, tells me that the issue of abortion is not because you're destroying a person, it is because you're destroying the potential that could develop into a person. If the halachic theory of abortion is not based on the fetus being a person, but it's based on the fetus having the potential to be a person, then the 40-day rule is going to be irrelevant, because you can say it's not a person that therefore requires a korban yoledes, but a potentiality it still is. And that is why most poskim, including Rav Moshe, have said that, some do argue, but they have said that the 40-day rule is not an abortion matter. There is no automatic heter for the 40 days. Now, if there would be, that would resolve stem cell retrieval, because stem cell retrieval is certainly done within 40 days. But as I say, Rav Moshe says, he didn't write about stem cells, of course, because he thought it was nifter before the technology. But, in other words, again, this is a subtle distinction. The Catholic position on abortion is based on fetal personhood. The Jewish prohibition of abortion is based on fetal potentiality. And those are two different analytical ways of viewing the situation. And it is only within the Catholic tradition that 40 days might be relevant, not within the Jewish tradition. Now, interestingly enough, I want to point out, Rav Unterman, the former Rav Rashi in Eretz Yisrael, he actually suggests that the issue of abortion for a ben Noach, because if a ben Noach does an abortion, it is ritzicha. So the very fact that it's more chamor is based on fetal personhood, and therefore he matters abortion for b'nei Noach, for goyim, less than 40 days. But he wouldn't matter it for Israel. This is a very fascinating example of the very fact that the Noahide law is stricter in making abortion a capital crime will give you the entree to matter abortion less than 40 days. That's a very good spur, because in Dinei B'nei Noach, abortion is murder mamish. In murder mamish, we can say, Pakas Mimem Yom is not a person. But since for a Jew it's not murder at all, it's only frustration of potential, Pachas Mimem Yom is not going to make a difference. Yeah.
What's Halacha's view towards single women, never married?
Yeah.
Getting older.
Yep.
And they want to freeze their ovum.
Yep.
For potential personhood.
Yes.
In the event that they get married. Then my second question is, what in the event that they don't get married, can they have that fertilized?
Yeah. So freezing eggs, at least for future use, is really not a problem at all. Where you get into a lot of controversy, and there's beginning to be some shuvas in this, is a single woman who would like to have artificial insemination from a sperm donor to be able to have a child without getting married, and as she's approaching the end of her fertile years. There is one psak from a great posuk in the Dati Lumi community, Rav Shurla, who was willing to consider it. Let me just point out, if you ask, is there any specific halacha that prohibits a single woman from being impregnated with a sperm bank, there actually is not. You're very hard-pressed to find a specific prohibition. And yet, the Gedolim have been very, very reluctant because they have two considerations. Number one, they have been very concerned about deliberately bringing children into the world who will not have the benefit of two parents. Now, it is true, of course, in the real world there is divorce, there is death, there is widowhood, that's b'diavad. But to lechatchila create children without a presence of both parents is considered to be against the Ruach HaTorah, which talks about three partners in a human being, the father, the mother, and Hashem. The second concern that Gedolim have had is we don't want to create incentives against getting married, meaning part of why a person gets married, part at least, is want to have kids. If we're creating avenues where you can have children outside of a Kiddushin, then Chas V'Shalom, you're undermining the significance of Kiddushin itself.
As a girl who's 40,
yep,
could argue, counter-argue.
Yes.
But have said, I want to get married, and I want to ensure that I can have children when I do get married. So this is my only way.
No. So what you said is fine. In other words, I was talking about being impregnated, artificially inseminated before.
So let's say that same girl's waiting, and now she's 50. She still hasn't gotten married, and her egg is frozen.
Yep.
Does she have a right to have it in a petri dish.
Well, that would be the issue. So it's Rav Sherlo himself, and again, I am not poskening on this at all. If anyone has a particular question, they need to take it up with their Rav. Rav Sherlo did say, he had all these rules. I mean, they're actually made up rules, but he basically said, if the woman has tried for over 10 years to find the shidduch and she is over 40, these are his two conditions, he said he would be willing to matter such a thing. But as I say, many, many Rabbanim have not approved this, and I'm certainly not approving. I'm just here to inform you of what was done out there. Okay, so the 40-day thing doesn't work. Now, what about the second idea? Some have advocated a concept. Well, abortion is permitted for pikuach nefesh of the mother, right? So here's the argument. Retrieving stem cells can provide life-saving therapy for people. So let's just matter it because of pikuach nefesh. It doesn't have to be pikuach nefesh of the mother. Let it be pikuach nefesh of somebody else. Can we just use pikuach nefesh as our heter? Well, this wouldn't work for a number of reasons. First of all, this would only work, pikuach nefesh applies only if the harvesting is going to be used in direct therapeutic help for someone who might otherwise die. If they're just going to experiment with it and test it and do other things, that's not called pikuach nefesh. There's a famous tshuva of the Native Yehuda about autopsies, in which doctors were arguing, hey, we have to be able to do autopsies because that gives us medical information about diseases that may save some life in 20 years. The Nehemiah Yehuda said, general research protocols that may yield medical knowledge that may save a life, that's speculative, he says that's not the heter of pikuach nefesh, because otherwise ein l'dover sof. If I'm a medical student, let me drive to the lecture that's being given on Shabbos, because maybe I'll hear something that will help me 15 years down the road to help a patient. There has to be what is called a cholo lefaneinu, a definite person. That's one aspect. But there's a deeper reason why pikuach nefesh doesn't always work here, because there's a big machlokas Rashi in the Rambam, and that is the following. The Mishnah says in Oalos, you cannot kill the fetus unless it is necessary to save the mother's life. If it's necessary to save the mother's life, you can kill the fetus. Question is, how can I kill one person to save another person? So listen to the Machlokas Rashi in the Rambam. Rashi says, the fetus is not a nefesh. The fetus is not yet a person. The mother is a person. So the life of an actual person has priority over the potentiality to become a person. That's what Rashi says. The Rambam is not satisfied with that reason. The Rambam gives a different reason. The Rambam says, when the source of the mother's endangerment is the fetus has the din of a rodef. The fetus is endangering the mother's life. And just like anyone else, if I'm about to shoot somebody, you know, I'm a rodef. So we can kill the fetus, not because actual is better than potential, but because the fetus is a rodef. Now, we think of a rodef as an evil person, a terrorist, or a suicide bomber that we can shoot down. And here you have a little fetus who has no malevolent intention. And yet, there is no halacha that a rodef has to be a bad guy. If a two-year-old baby, God forbid, is brandishing a loaded gun, and the only way it could be disabled, the only way, is by shooting, you are permitted to do that. You know, you may have heard these Holocaust stories, they may not be true, about a crying baby was giving away the whereabouts of the Jews that were hiding in a bunker, and if they would be discovered, all of them would be killed. According to Halacha, God should save us from ever having to confront this. One is allowed to kill the baby to save the other people, because even a crying baby can halachically be a rodef. Rodef does not mean you got to be a bad person with evil intentions. So, the Rambam says, a fetus can be a rodef. So, we have two different reasons why I can kill the fetus to save the mother. One is potential versus actual, that's Rashi. The other is Rodef. The Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rambam that it's because of Rodef. Now, this theoretical machlokas has direct connection to the issue of stem cell research. Can I destroy an embryo in order to save the life of a Parkinson's patient in the hospital? According to Rashi, the argument is yes. The embryo is only potential. That patient is actual. I'm allowed to kill the potential to save the actual. But according to the Rambam, it's not going to work. Because the hedger of the Rambam to kill the embryo is only because the embryo is the source of the danger to the mother. But that's not true in the case of stem cells. I'm harvesting the stem cells here to save the life of somebody there. There is no way that this embryo can be defined as a rodent of the other entity, because the embryo is not the reason, right? The other person is in danger because of their illness, not because of anything the embryo is doing.
So can you potentially say that someone who's withholding treatment that could save someone's life is a rodent?
Yeah, I understand that. That's an interesting point, but I think that would go far too far, because at most we would only say that if there's a halachic obligation, and there is no halachic obligation to give up my life to save another person's life. See, so you can't call, let me give you an example. If I don't put my life at risk to save you when I could have saved you, I could not be called a rodeh for failure to do that, because that's beyond the ambit of my responsibility. You see? So the point is I'm making is that to apply the law of rodeh, that if the heter of abortion to save the mother is based on rodeh, that's not going to be a stem cell heter. So we talked about the 40-day heter, we talked about a pikuach nefesh heter, but let me give you a third heter that in fact Baruch Hashem has been accepted, has been widely accepted. And the first time I heard this, before I even came across halacha, this was, I call this the Orrin Hatch heter. Orrin Hatch is a United States Senator. Of course, they call Netanyahu United States Senator too. They call him a Republican Senator from Israel. But Orrin Hatch is a Senator from Utah. He's a Mormon. And he is also very much against abortion based on his religion. But he was trying to figure out how the stem cells fit in with abortion. And this is what he came up with. And what he came up with is exactly the analysis that Rav Ovadia, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, again, and even Rav Yashiv was maskin to it as well. And that is the following idea. If you understand that the theory of abortion is not based on the fetus being a person, but it's based on the fetus having the potential to become a person, right? Fetal potentiality rather than fetal personhood, the argument might be that it is only treated as a potential when it's in the environment where it is capable in the normal course of development of becoming a person, i.e., it's already in a womb. In a petri dish, even if you let it grow, after a month it'll just fall apart. It cannot be sustained in the petri dish. So the argument goes that even if you say abortion is prohibited even within 40 days, as Rav Moshe said, that will only apply after it is implanted in a womb. But prior to womb implantation, the laws of abortion do not apply. And as a result, the harvesting of embryonic stem cells, at least for important medical research, can be justified based on that notion. It is a pre-abortion fetus, right? A pre-abortion embryo. In fact, some researchers, although I don't give credence to names, they call it a pre-embryo. They actually use the term pre-embryo for embryos that have not yet been implanted in the womb. And halacha may very well recognize this, that there is a psak that kama v'kama gedolim, and I know the OU has taken this position based on their poskim as well. Now, this has some very interesting repercussions beyond embryonic stem cell research. This could be an ASA. Let me give you an example. You're familiar with Dor Yesharim, which is a genetic counseling organization that's designed to discourage shiduchim between people that are carriers of serious genetic illnesses. They started off with Tay-Sachs. They enlarge it. Some people are concerned they're enlarging it too much by putting in all sorts of other things that are not the same. But Let's imagine, God forbid, the following scenario. I'll give you another scenario. You have a couple that didn't use Dor Yeshivim, or maybe they married before Dor Yeshivim. And, God forbid, they discover they're both carriers for Tay-Sachs. What do they do? What do they do? So, let's go over the options. Option number one, get divorced. Marry somebody else, because you have to have two carriers to have a child with the illness.
So there's a one in four chance.
Oh, there is a one in four chance, I understand.
One in four chance.
Yeah, I understand. Let me finish. So option number one is get divorced in order to avoid the problem. Option number two, permanent contraception. But you have a problem. Number one, it's only one in four that's going to have the illness, and there's a 75% chance. And number two, there's a mitzvah pruer vu. How can you just deliberately be on permanent contraception? Option number three, take your chances, and if there's a Tay-Sachs baby, and it's determined by amniocentesis and do abortion, well, Rav Oldenburg would permit, but again, Rav Moshe Feinstein said there is absolutely no hetzer for aborting a Tay-Sachs baby. God forbid, it's considered to be abortion, so that's not going to be allowed. Option number four, we might call this the option of the tzaddik, of the righteous couple. And again, on the highest level, this is what it should be. Accept what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you with love. Pray, be mispalel. Maybe you'll beat the odds, maybe you won't, but you accept. Gamzul Batova. But again, that in an ideal spiritual sense, that should be the perspective, but some people cannot take that. Some people will break down. But now, let's consider option number five. Option number five is that try to achieve all pregnancies through an in vitro fertilization and then engage in pre-implantation genetic screening. And if you go with the hanacha that the laws of abortion do not apply until the fertilized embryo is implanted into the womb, then halachically, even according to Rav Moshe, who prohibits a Tay-Sachs abortion, a Tay-Sachs abortion would be permitted in a pre-implantation genetic screening. Now, whether this should be so, again, as I say, certainly one does not do this for sex selection. One does not, you don't do pre-implantation genetic screening because I want a redhead kid. I mean, you really can't do that. I want a ginger or whatever it will be. But at least for something like Tay-Sachs, which is a very, very debilitating disease, these would be hetero. Now, it's important to understand that there is a halacha and there is a hashkafa. God forbid, one is not suggesting pre-implantation genetic screening is the optimal, perfect thing to do. Certainly a Jew has to, we all have to learn to be makabel, the divine will. But at least these are avenues that are available, and it does open up. So the very heter for the stem cell retrieval can also be utilized as a genetic planning tool, and again, in consultation with one's rav and one's posek. Have a good morning.